Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space for the war for the free world. And there is no one who understands that war better, who is more helpfully contributing to its contemporaneous historical analysis than our first guest. He is Victor Davis Hanson, a man of many parts, truly a Renaissance man. He is currently the Martin and Illy Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. He is the author of more books than we have time for even now. We're going to just mention one, The Father of Us All, War and History, Ancient and Modern. Victor, very, very much appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk with us. Welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
Let's visit, if we can, again, from the perspective of an extraordinary world-class historian on this post-American presidency of Barack Obama. We're now, of course, lurching into the sort of 2.0 model of it. What did you make of the first 4 years, and what do you think we have in store for us, given the greater flexibility, as he likes to say, that he now has, having been reelected?
I think the first 4 years, he sort of prepped the battlefield for the next 4 years. In other words, that he was restrained by certain worries, mostly about being reelected. But now, he's Obama unbound, and he doesn't feel constrained by the bipartisan foreign policy of the last 65 years, which both Republicans and mostly Democrats shared. In fact, Democrats helped craft it in the 40s. Of containment and this idea of a globalization could follow from a U.S. enforced protocol on everything from trade to travel to communications to the high seas being safe there. But for Obama, it's lead from behind in Libya, it's asking the Arab League and the U.N. but not the U.S. Congress for permission to use force, it's lectures about Syria, doing something, doing nothing, doing sort of something, it's embrace of de facto embrace the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which is turning into Somalia. It's letting the French do what they have to do in Mali. Its resets failed. And there's a common denominator here, and that is that for a variety of reasons, he doesn't believe that the United States should or can have the power to be preeminent and should be the world's sort of go-to person to deter local threats. And I don't know why that is, but I have some suspicions that he either feels that the United States history or its formation, or its constitution, or its traditions and protocols in terms of race, class, and gender is unequal, unfair, or perhaps he believes that we've done things, whether it's Vietnam or Iraq, that nullify our claim to preeminence. Or maybe he feels that there's other countries and other traditions abroad that are just as important as ours and will be one of many powers. But we get the impression that the Arab League, the United Nations, France, Britain, the EU, all of them, should have an equal say in with the United States in adjudicating problems around the world. It's a very different long explanation for something that's very different than what we've seen in the last 65 years.
No, it's an elegant and very, very, I think, to the point exposition. Let me ask you this. We have been discussing with a number of our guests in recent days the question of whether what Obama is doing with respect to the United States military, Victor Davis Hanson, to kind of enforce this changed stature in the world and limit the capabilities of the United States and basically rebalance the world, I guess, in a way, if I've heard you right, is to take out the military, kind of a wrecking operation on the United States Armed Forces. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it's very sophisticated, though. It's to borrow $1 trillion in 5 consecutive years and then rail against tax cuts, but then keep them for 99% of the people. So there's a revenue and spending problem, apparently, especially with a flat economy. And so one of the dividends in Obama's way of thinking is that there becomes a pressing need to cut defense to get it down below 3% GDP and then to transfer the so-called savings, not to end the deficits or pay down the debt, but to create a social redistribution of European-style state. And that's what he's done with everything from Social Security disability to food stamps to unemployment insurance to expansions in entitlement. And so it's almost like saying, well, I wouldn't want to cut the defense, but I have to because we're broke and we have all these pressing social needs that have accrued from this economic downturn.
Only in his heart of hearts, he's only too happy to actually cut the defense.
I think he is. I think that he thinks that a big, powerful military gets us into wars abroad and it terrorizes people. And if you look at what he'd said about Guantanamo or renditions or drones or preventive detention or Iraq, it's pretty clear, even though he embraced or expanded some of those protocols when he actually had the responsibility of office, it's pretty clear he was deeply suspicious about the use of U.S. power.
Our guest again is Victor Davis Hanson. He is, among other things, a syndicated columnist. He writes for the National Review and Tribune Media Services. He is also associated with the Hoover Institution and the author, among other things, of Between War and Peace, Lessons from Afghanistan and Iraq. And Victor, let's just quickly talk about the several individuals that President Obama seeks to place in key national security posts. They all seem to share this general philosophy of post-Americanism, if I can call it that. John Kerry now installed as the Secretary of State, of course. Chuck Hagel, having had a dismal performance in the Senate Armed Services Committee last week, now in some jeopardy of being repudiated by the Senate, I hope. And then John Brennan to become the next director of the Central Intelligence Agency. What make you of these guys, and what will the world make of them should they be confirmed?
Well, they're sort of force multipliers, and they've all had a prize soundbite. With John Brennan, we were lectured that jihad is more of a personal journey. It doesn't mean an Islamic quest to spread armed conflict and conversion.
Holy war.
Yeah, holy war. That's the person who now heads the CIA but doesn't believe that jihad is anything other than sort of a touchy-feely inner quest for spiritual purity. And that's very dangerous to think that. And then we have John Kerry, who told us, lectured us, sermonized that Bashar Assad was a reformer. He went over to Syria a number of times. And that's very scary. And then we have Chuck Hagel, who declared that the successful surge was one of the most dangerous moves since the Vietnam War and disastrous moves, and the Jewish lobby and all the other things he said. So you get the impression that each will multiply the other. And with Obama himself, we've got four people now who, if we look at particular elements of U.S. foreign policy, they're going to change. Our relationship with Israel is going to change. The way we conduct the war on terror, I think, is going to change. The way we look at the Arab world is going to change. And I think it's kind of scary because I had my differences with Clinton at State and even Robert Gates and Panetta at Defense and Panetta at the CIA. But what everyone says, what anybody says, Panetta was a far better person at Defense than Hagel will be, and Petraeus is far better than Brennan will be, and even Hillary Clinton is probably going to be better than Kerry will be.
Let me ask you this. Again, this is drawing on your insights, not only as a brilliant thinker on these matters, but also as a really quite accomplished historian. What does history tell us when the United States engages in this kind of defeatism and disengagement and, declinism, I guess, is another way to describe it?
Well, we've been in this situation before. We were that way on the eve of World War One, and we almost lost Britain and France until the United States belatedly intervened in 1917. And we did the same thing in 39, 40, and 41, and we had to intervene. And then most scary, I think, was after 1946 when Harry Truman and Lewis Johnson wanted to disband the Marine Corps, and we ended up just 5 years later caught in Korea with the North Koreans having had access to better tanks and planes and almost annihilated us at Pusan. So we go through these stages, and we did it again after the Vietnam War, and then we found that Ronald Reagan came in. If he had not have reformulated the military, we would have never been able to fight the first Gulf War. So in democracies, there's these yin and yang of public opinion toward defense investment, but in this country, anytime we've decided that the world is too expensive, it doesn't go our way, we don't like it, or we don't have any right, then the world just goes on and it draws us in at a later date, whether we like it or not, and at much higher cost.
That's the point.
That's the point.
Yeah, the false economy of these kinds of budget cuts
is
just painful because it's lives as well as treasure, as you know so well. Victor Davis Hanson, thank you so much for taking this time with us. We look forward to visiting with you, I hope, often in 2013, and appreciate so much your work at the Hoover Institution and at National Review, among other places. Next up, John Bolton joins us. We'll talk with him about nominations that we've been discussing with Victor and Iran. What are we doing with them? Straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, the Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by another of our favorite people, John Bolton, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations and Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, among many other distinguished posts he held in the United States government. John Bolton has been a leading force for good in terms of helping clarify the world we're in and understand the importance of remaining vigilant and strong to deal with it. His most recent book is How Barack Obama is Endangering Our National Sovereignty, which followed on to his superb best-selling book, Surrender is Not an Option. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back. It's great to have you with us.
Good with you, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Listen, I want to spend much of our time talking with you about an issue that you have really a mastery of, as much as anyone, I think, in this country, namely Iran and its nuclear ambitions. We had the spectacle, I think is the only word for it, of Chuck Hagel during his nomination hearing last week, seemingly misspeaking, but perhaps in the Freudian slip sense of the word, actually speaking exactly what's going on here, namely that he spoke of the president's policy of containment of Iran Is that how you see things, that we are in the business now of trying to contain Iran? And if so, what are the dangers associated therewith?
Well, as you say, I'm afraid that Hegel gave away the store when he said initially that he supported a policy of containment when it came to Iran's nuclear weapons program, and then misstating it again and finally corrected by Carl Levin. You know, there were three possible answers Hegel could have given. Two were wrong and one was right, and he gave both wrong answers. If it weren't for Levin, he'd probably still be there.
Yeah.
The administration says repeatedly, our policy is to stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons. We don't have a containment policy to deal with them after they actually get the weapons. And I believe that's technically correct only because their policy today is prevention, but their policy tomorrow, after prevention fails, will be containment. They will say they don't like it, but they believe that they can contain and deter a nuclear Iran as we contained and deterred the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And I think that's what Hegel, you know, he was just probably confused in his head about what he was hearing in his briefings. But I'm very worried that's the direction the administration's going in. I think the notion of containing the mullahs with nuclear weapons is delusional. But I think that's what that's the direction the administration is heading in.
Now, John Bolton, you spent a lot of time during the Cold War thinking about and contending with the challenge of initially containing the Soviet Union, and then you helped Ronald Reagan bring about their overthrow when he pursued a rollback strategy. What are the differences, as you see them, between containing the USSR and containing the Iranian mullahs?
Well, the calculus among the communists in Moscow for their own reasons was that ultimately they feared the consequences of striking America first. They knew we would destroy them. The mental approach of the mullahs in Tehran is very nearly the opposite of that of the communists. Bernard Lewis, the great scholar of the Middle East, put it very well, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said, you know, if you believe life in the hereafter is better than life on Earth, the notion of mutual assured destruction is not a deterrent to using nuclear weapons. It's an incentive, because the mullahs would be sent to their version of heaven. But look, even if we're completely wrong on the question of containment, the other critical difference from Cold War days is that it doesn't stop with Iran. If Iran gets nuclear weapons, which they're on the verge of doing, Saudi Arabia will get nuclear weapons, so will Egypt, so will Turkey, perhaps others. So what is already an extraordinarily dangerous and volatile Middle East could have as many as half a dozen nuclear weapon states in a very short period of time. That's why, even if the administration is right, and I clearly think they're not, but even if they were right that you could contain Iran, that doesn't solve the problem.
Yeah. And let's be clear, Ambassador John Bolton, that many of those states are likely to be in the hands of terrorists, jihadists, Islamists, call them what you will, in the not-too-distant future. Let me ask you this. One of the other places where Chuck Hagel got embroiled in controversy, I think, is he lied to members of the Senate Armed Services Committee about his stance on our own nuclear forces. And to the extent, as you say, Ambassador Bolton, that we are looking at a world that is likely to be much more proliferated, and many of these weapons in the hands of people who may think that, as you say, it's a shortcut to paradise to use them, to launch Armageddon, the folly of his position on favoring our own unilateral nuclear disarmament and calling for it in a report that he co-authored back in May of last year really strikes me as a disqualifier for the job of Secretary of Defense. What say you?
Well, unfortunately, the Senate committee didn't really pin him down on that. But look, I can tell you, I had conversations with Max Kampelman, recently deceased, who was one of the leaders of the so-called nuclear zero moment. And I have a lot of respect for Max Kampelman as a true patriot who gave great service to his country. But as I said to him in several lunches we had over the years, I thought this attitude about simply eliminating our nuclear capability because it would provide an example to the rest of the world was a profoundly dangerous policy. And Max Kampelman himself said to me, you know, I don't buy this argument that we get there through arms control negotiations. I think arms control negotiations are worthless. I want to short circuit that and do it directly. So now for people who have been proponents of nuclear zero to say, well, you know, that's actually not what we meant. I mean, that smacks of what we call confirmation conversion. And that's why I think Cagle went into that hearing with a lot of problems, but he came out with two more. One was a character problem of being willing to throw over pretty much everything he had said of any controversy previously and take the opposite view. And also the competence question, as we discussed earlier, not knowing about what the containment versus prevention was on Iran's nuclear program, not knowing where the defense budget sequestration danger came from, and a whole series of other miscues.
Yeah, it was an appalling performance, and I hope it will be deemed by a sufficient number of senators, at least on the Republican side, and I'd like to thank some Democrats as well. It's unbecoming, to say the least, of a secretary.
Well, I think now the spotlight will be on John McCain and what he decides to do. If he decides to oppose the nomination and back it up with a potential filibuster, then I think it could be in real trouble.
Yeah. Well, if not John McCain, I'm trusting some other senator will step forward to do that, because it's certainly required. Again, you've spent many years worrying on the nuclear Iran front. What do you make of Joe Biden's pronouncement at the Security Conference, used to be called, I think, Verkunde, maybe it still is, in Munich over the weekend, that the United States government is now prepared for direct negotiations with the Iranian regime? On what basis could they possibly be thinking that's in order at the moment?
Well, you know, this is a view they've had for 4 years. It was wrong 4 years ago. It's wrong today. The only surprise to me is that Iran hasn't taken them up on their offer to negotiate seriously earlier, because it helps Iran buy time to advance its program. It gives them legitimacy. I think now, with a new Secretary of State, a new Secretary of Defense coming in, there's a very real chance that the new team will say, you know, we can solve all these problems. Boy, if only we could sit down at the table with Iran, we can find a way through this. And when you combine that with the perennial weakness of the European negotiation view, I'm very worried that they're going to go in and weaken the sanctions, which have taken an economic toll on Iran, even though they haven't slowed the nuclear weapons program down. And that Iran once again will clean our clocks when we try and negotiate with them.
Yeah, I fear you're right. Two quick questions. Should the United States be arming the Egyptian military? And should John Brennan become the next director of the Central Intelligence Agency?
Well, you know, I would suspend military aid to Egypt now because of the policies of the Morsi government. I think we're in a very difficult situation trying to play for advantage to get a government in Egypt that upholds Camp David and protects American interests. So I would not cut it off. I'd suspend it and I'd work on the military. And I think John Brennan's going to have, if you thought Chuck Hagel's confirmation hearing was interesting, I think Brennan's is going to be even more interesting, because he's going to get it from both the left and the right, and deservedly so from the right, not so deservedly from the left. But he could have more difficulties, because I think he could face defections from the Democrats, which we haven't yet, so far anyway, seen in the Hagel case.
Yeah, well, he should be blocked, it seems to me, and I'm delighted to have your insights into that. Let's hope you're right. John Bolton, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, thank you as always for joining us. We look forward to visiting with you again often in 2013. Keep up the great work at Fox and elsewhere. And next up, we will be speaking with Michael Rubin, your colleague at the American Enterprise Institute, on Iran and Turkey and much, much more. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It is with sound mind and body that I, James Fredericks III, after fighting with all direct family members for decades, leave my entire fortune of $32 million to the one friend I had in the end, the package delivery guy, Matt Songer.
Woohoo! Yeah! I had a feeling about this. Uh-huh! I'm rich! Oh, this cannot be happening.
Actually, it's not happening. What?
And it never will.
I don't get it.
There aren't even people here. That's just one of those murmuring sound effects.
Seriously?
Listen, if you want to have money in your future, don't rely on luck.
Huh.
Put $10 away each month. Cook once in a while instead of eating out.
Okay.
Pay down your high-interest credit cards.
Right.
Small changes today, big bucks tomorrow.
So, no inheritance?
No. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
And just to be clear, no inheritance, right?
This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Advertisers pay millions for the chance to reach a global audience for even a few seconds during the Super Bowl. The value of the 35 minutes in which the New Orleans Superdome was partially blacked out, however, could be literally priceless. After all, the resulting protracted interruption of the most watched event in the country powerfully conveys the message of our dependence upon electricity. We shouldn't need it after the devastating and widespread blackouts caused by Hurricanes Sandy and New Orleans' own Katrina, but we still haven't taken the steps necessary to protect our electrical grid against natural disasters or crippling man-caused cyber warfare or electromagnetic pulse attacks. Fortunately, the lights came back on eventually last night. If we act now, we can harden the grid and ensure they don't go out for America permanently. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedomradio.com.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement? And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
I'm a champion, realize Shaq's mechanism. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hi, Shaquille O'Neal for Rad. This is not your normal PSA. Don't be stupid. Don't drink and drive. If you're going to go out and have a good time, it's fine. But designate a driver to drive home. Let's stop the madness. Don't drink and drive.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Dr. Michael Rubin, one of the guys that I consider a national treasure when it comes to his mastery of the Middle East and his ability to help explain what's going on there to the rest of us. Dr. Rubin is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, the author of numerous books and innumerable articles, and a guest that I just treasure having with us from time to time. Welcome back, Michael. It's good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Frank.
Let's visit first and foremost about a topic that I've been touching on with Victor Davis Hanson and John Bolton earlier in the program, namely this, well, willful blindness, I think, is the best way to describe it, that we've seen exhibited by the Obama administration and kind of personified by John Brennan, the man that President Obama thinks of all people in the United States is best suited to become the next director of Central Intelligence. Specifically, Michael, the idea that he refuses to describe the threat we're facing, which even Hillary Clinton has now described as a global jihadist threat, as jihad because he thinks that it's about personal struggle, not about holy war. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that sometimes political correctness can kill. Here's where intellectually I think he's just flat out wrong. Many of the Islamists, the radical Islamists, want to take religion and state and society back to what they see as the golden age, which existed 1,000 years ago. Now, what John Brennan is doing wrong is he's taking an interpretation which is put forward by some people today. But if you want to get into the minds of the so-called jihadists, you have to understand what jihad meant 1,000 years ago. And when you look, for example, in Bukhari's collection of hadith, he dedicated 1/3 of a volume of hadith, I mean, one of the most important sources of Islamic law, simply to jihad as holy war and as offensive holy war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're under no illusion what it means. And unfortunately, it really does come down to, as you say, putting us all in jeopardy that we persist in thinking it's something else.
Well, this is actually why universities have made themselves so irrelevant, because they spend so much time debating over what the proper terms are that oftentimes they do this simply as a way to avoid tackling the major issues. Now, that's one thing to happen in some ivory tower somewhere. It's another thing if you don't have the focus at the Central Intelligence Agency to target the people who are killing you.
Yeah, amen. Let me ask you about several other issues that are now evidencing this kind of jihadist impulse and threat that are in your area of expertise, Dr. Michael Rubin. Let's start with Egypt. We've had a warning from the defense minister of Egypt, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, that his country is, quote, on the brink of collapse, unquote. Do you agree? And if so, what's the cause and what's likely to come next?
Well, I certainly agree. And frankly, the cause is the Muslim Brotherhood. They promised people the world and they've shown that they can't deliver. Instead of trying to repair the economy, what they've been trying to do is impose this radical ideology, this radical Islamist ideology on everyone around them.
Yeah.
Now, the military is basically sitting back and laughing as the Muslim Brotherhood digs a hole, figuring at the last minute the military can come in and rescue Egyptian society and basically say, we told you so, you shouldn't mess with these guys. The danger is, however, that perhaps folks in the Obama administration are going to throw a lifeline to a failing regime. Egypt should not be considered too big to fail, nor should U.S. taxpayer money be an entitlement to an incredibly hostile and hateful regime.
And what do you make, given that scenario, Michael Rubin, of the idea of selling additional arms? We've just apparently delivered 4 new F-16 aircraft to the Egyptian military. Is that advisable or inadvisable in your judgment?
No, I mean, it most certainly is a self-inflicted wound. This is a regime which is at present helping Hamas. Certainly, perhaps the Obama administration will say, oh, but this is going to the military. But Mohamed Morsi has shown enough strength so far to force the military to stand down on the issues relating to the Gaza Strip. And therefore, we're playing a very, very dangerous game, not only in Egypt, where we're giving the F-16s, but also, frankly, in Turkey, where we're talking about giving them the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter and the software codes which go with it. That's our most advanced platform, which is supposed to be the platform upon which the next generation of American air power sets.
Yeah. I was going to come next to Turkey, as it happens. You are very knowledgeable about that country. You've probably chronicled as well as anybody, Michael Rubin, the trajectory that it has followed under this Islamist Recep Tayyip Erdogan. What is its current status? You perhaps heard over the weekend the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff describing, as we are wont to do, is this country as a great ally of the United States. Is it today, and where will it be in the not too distant future if this trajectory continues?
No, I mean, Turkey most certainly is not an ally. Perhaps it's an ally when people have their heads in the sand back in Washington, but let's look at this. I mean, people used to say Turkey's a democracy. Well, the Reporters Without Frontiers 2013 report came out, and Turkey has now fallen several more slots. So it's not only below Russia when it comes to press freedom and below Venezuela when it comes to press freedom. It's now below even Iraq when it comes to press freedom. And just over this past week, it seems that the Turkish government has been holding a close conference, to try to unite not Hamas and Fatah back in the Palestinian areas, but unite al-Qaeda in Iraq. I mean, this is a truly radical regime, which should be scaring the heck out of all of us, especially, I mean, 20 million, they've increased their trade with Turkey, I'm sorry, with Iran to $20 billion. This is something that should be of deep concern. And we have the prime minister. You can't get more. I mean, this is like some sort of Saturday Night Live parody of what Islamism is all about when you have the prime minister of Turkey berating Syria for not doing more to fight against Israel after Israel bombed chemical weapons which were destined for Hezbollah.
Mm. Yeah. Do you have evidence that they were chemical weapons they were going after, not simply these S-17 missiles, SA-17?
Well, certainly when it comes to the missiles and when it comes to the chemical weapons, there appears to be a little bit more than what the headlines are saying. Certainly, Israel has made clear that their main focus right now is watching for the transfer of any of these advanced weaponry from Syria into Hezbollah's hands, and yet it seems that is exactly what the Syrian government is trying to do. The Israelis are damned if they do, damned if they don't, on one hand because you have people like Recep Tayyip Erdogan trying to rally the international community, but on the other hand, if Assad stays, they have to worry about Hezbollah with chemical weapons. If Assad falls, you have opposition, which is now so thoroughly radicalized because we have been sitting on the sidelines for so long that Israel would be facing an al-Qaeda state on its borders.
Dr. Michael Rubin is our guest. He is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He is also a man who served as a political advisor to the coalition provisional authority in Iraq. And during that time, Michael, you obviously had a lot of opportunity to reflect on what Syria was up to. We've talked a bit about the conflict between Israel and Syria, the efforts that the Turks, the Iranians, and others are making to jockey for position in Syria at the moment. Given where we are, what would you recommend we do at this point to have a better outcome in Syria, if anything?
Well, this is where the Obama administration simply doesn't get it. They have a belief that time and timelines don't matter, that they can sit on the sidelines and they're still going to have the same range of options that they had a year ago or 2 years ago. The fact of the matter is, we've been sitting on our hands so long, there really is not a magic solution to what's going on in Syria right now. Al-Qaeda has set down its roots. At the very least, we have to simply contain the problem right now, whether it's Bashar al-Assad or whether it's these more radical elements. The last thing we should be doing, however, is funding, supporting, or equipping the Syrian opposition, because the Syrian opposition has been so thoroughly radicalized.
Yeah, I guess that's where I was going to go with this in just the last minute we have, Michael Rubin. It is clearly the case that it has al-Qaeda elements in it. The path to defeat that al-Qaeda is supposed to be on, I take it, you would not buy.
No, I wouldn't buy. As soon as Obama was successful in the operation that killed Osama bin Laden, we had an expiration date put on all the intelligence that came with him. We exploited that intelligence for a year, but now, once again, we are flying blind, and we see that not only in Mali, but in Syria and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. And we wind up killing people that might be able to provide fresh intelligence rather than trying to take them alive and interrogate them, because we don't do that sort of thing anymore. Michael Rubin, we are reliant critically upon your intelligence and appreciate it tremendously that you share it with us with great generosity. We look forward to talking with you again in the very near future. Next up, we've got Gordon Chang. He'll be talking with us about China's new militancy. The problem over there, too, is China takes a wrong turn. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medication, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call, and I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system system and helps you lose fat? Talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the Meta System. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Dennis Prager thinks there should be a simple standard to textbooks.
I'll tell you how I think a textbook should be written. This is what happened. Period.
That is the role of the text.
And if nearly everybody who did something important in American history, if 78.9% of them were WASP males, then I want 78.9% of the textbook to reflect that fact.
I care about truth.
That's why I'm not on the left.
The Dennis Prager Show.
Up in the morning and out to school.
Weeknights at 10 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Gordon Chang, our duty expert here at Secure Freedom Radio on Asia, a portfolio that he addresses masterfully for, among others, Forbes.com and World Affairs Journal and Fox News. He is very generous with his time. We visit with him this point in the program each week. And Gordon, it's always a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Let's start with something you've written about in The Diplomat, one of your other outlets, entitled China's New Militancy. We talk about this a lot, but you make the case pretty persuasively, I think, that China is in fact ratcheting up its repressive behavior at home and its aggressiveness both towards those like the Tibetans and others in the region. Let's start maybe with what it's doing at home and what it portends for the rest of us if they're treating their own people badly.
What's really a concern right now is that the political leadership of China, and specifically Xi Jinping, the leader, have been engaging in war talk. You know, in the past, we've had Chinese generals and admirals talk about waging war on the United States and relishing the prospect of attacking some country. But now we have the Chinese leaders talk about getting ready for war in very strident tones. And clearly what we've got is a consensus now in the Chinese capital that China needs a war. And so clearly, I don't know if they'll actually go out and be as good as their words, but nonetheless, they have warned us what they want to do, and we need to prepare ourselves.
Yeah. And these are the civilians that are nominally in charge as the leaders of the party of the military. So as you say, Gordon Chang, when you see this kind of convergence, this suggests that the decks are being cleared for action. Again, an indicator perhaps is how they are handling Tibet at the moment. Talk a little bit about your findings in connection with the crackdown there.
Well, the crackdown is intensifying. After 2008, it seemed that they couldn't tighten down anymore, but they are doing that at the present time. They're sealing the borders between Tibet, India, and Nepal. And essentially what's happening is they're preventing the Tibetans from fleeing. This is preventing us from knowing what's going on inside Tibet. We do know that there have been 99 self-immolations since February 2009, and this is a sign of the increasing desperation of the Tibetan people.
And Gordon, we're also witnessing, of course, in addition to their barbarity towards their own folks, or people that they claim are their own folks, like the Tibetans, an increasing aggressiveness towards the neighbors, notably towards Japan over the Senkakus, and towards the Philippines over Scarborough Shoal. What is the latest on that score in terms of the assertion of Chinese presence, including through military forces, and how is it being perceived by those in the community, in the neighborhood?
Well, the latest is that the Chinese have engaged in another incursion into Japanese waters. This is about the 25th since last September. The Chinese have also been overflying the disputed islands, which the Japanese call the Senkakus and which the Chinese call the Daoyus. The Japanese administer these islands, in fact, and so what China is trying to do is use these forceful tactics to take them away from Japan. Now, this is important because the Chinese used these same forceful tactics against the Philippines last year, and they were successful in taking away Scarborough Shoal. And this is important because the United States has an obligation to defend Philippine territory, and we essentially reneged on our mutual defense treaty. We taught the Chinese that aggression works against the Philippines, and so they're now using the same tactics against Japan. We just really prepared the groundwork for the Chinese to be as bad as they possibly can. So we have to change our posture.
Well, as we talked about earlier in the program with Victor Davis Hanson, Gordon Chang, we almost certainly will see a reprise of what we have seen in the past, where others perceive this weakness and irresolution as an invitation to, well, have that war that you say the Chinese leadership now seems to be deciding would be in their interest. It rarely works out to be in anybody's interest, but you nonetheless see these kinds of invitations communicated, unintentionally, of course. I'm worried particularly, Gordon, I've seen, and I don't have the numbers right at hand, but I have seen reports as to the reductions in the number of steaming days the United States Navy expects to have in the Western Pacific as a result of this sequestration round of budget cuts that is looming. The number was something on the order of 20 or 30%, I think. How will this reinforce, as I imagine it will, Chinese perceptions, and does that simply further increase the likelihood of bloodshed in your estimation?
Well, I think that as the United States decreases its military presence around the world and decreases steaming days, it just encourages the Chinese to increase their provocative behavior. And we've seen this now with regard to Japan. The Japanese really don't know what to do right now. Prime Minister Abe has extended an open hand to the Chinese, and the Chinese responded by even more incursions into Japanese waters. The United States needs to put its destroyers, its aircraft carriers, its submarines around those islands. And if we can't do that, we're just telling the Chinese that basically it's open season on the Japanese and everybody else in the region.
Hmm. And our official position, as I understand it, Gordon, has been that we take no stance on the sovereignty matter, but that we do have a responsibility to defend them, the Japanese, but we're increasingly incapable of doing it. At the same time, we're hearing from that estimable old China hand, well, China running dog, I think is more accurate, Henry Kissinger, that we need to appease the Chinese. What's going on that score, and is there any surprise from the man that China has paid handsomely over the years to represent their interests, I believe?
Yeah, Henry Kissinger believes that we should have a cooperative approach, and the way that he looks at this is that we should ignore Chinese provocations and try to build bridges, which is exactly the wrong way of approaching things, as we've seen in 1939 at other crucial points in history. You know, when Henry Kissinger was a professor at Harvard, he wrote a great book about the Congress of Vienna. And what he said in there was that when peace is considered to be the ultimate objective of the international system, the least responsible member of the community sets the tone. And that's exactly what's happening now with China and North Korea. But he also said that when the international community felt that certain principles could not be sacrificed, at least an equilibrium that would relate, that would end up in stability was possible. And that's what we need to make clear to the Chinese, that peace is not the objective. What is the objective is the security of our treaty allies and friends in the region. Because if we don't do that, we're going to end up in a conflict. You can see this slow motion move to a conflict in Asia. And when it does occur, it's going to be one that history will remember.
Yeah, and it may be accelerating, as I think your point, Gordon Chang. I'm not so wild about that international community bit, but I do think that the United States and its allies have to act in concert on this, and most especially with American leadership and power. Speaking of the United States in all of this, Gordon Chang, you have doubtless been following as a contributor from time to time to the New York Times that it has been attacked by the Chinese hacking operations. What do you make of that, and what does it portend for not just the Gray Lady, but for the rest of us?
We've reached a tipping point on this, because the Chinese have been hacking American businesses, the American government, the Pentagon, defense contractors, foreign governments for decades. But now it really has captured the imagination of the American people, because the New York Times was hacked, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, new revelations about the Department of Energy. And so the administration has had to start to think about how to defend American networks. And here, this is something that the Republican Party needs a much better attitude on as well, because right now they just have been stalling. And so I think that what we really need is a consensus in this country to defend our computer networks. We need Republicans and Democrats working together, because if they don't, we are going to suffer even more losses from Chinese cyber intrusions.
Yeah, and I assume what you mean by that, and we only have 30 seconds here, Gordon Chang, is offensive capabilities as well as defensive.
Yes, I mean, in the 2003 blackout, which the Chinese may have occurred, 50 Americans died. We got to remember that.
It's time to be on the offense, not simply passively responding to these, if any response at all is
forthcoming.
Gordon Chang, we have to let you go. Thank you very much, as always, for joining us. It's very important work that you're monitoring, and we appreciate, again, you sharing it with all of us. We'll look forward to our visit next week, same time, same station, and that will be true of, I hope, the rest of you tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.